can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Well, the hot topic around the world, sporting-wise, Don, is probably Mr. Novak's Djokovic's predicament he finds himself in before the Australian Open starts here in Melbourne, Australia. And as Ben Fordham, we were going to ask Ben about it, who is going to be a regular on this, but he couldn't come today, but he put us on to a man I've known for many years. I don't know him. I've never met him personally.
Listened to.
He's been doing this for, we'll ask him in a minute because he's listening to this. He's been doing this for 30 or 40 years. An international, the preeminent, quintessential tennis broadcaster and aficionado of what's going on in the world of tennis. And we thought if anyone would have an insight into what is going on with Mr. Djokovic and what his opinion is, it'll probably vary from ours or differ from mine. But we've got Craig Gabriel on the phone. He's based in Sydney, Australia. He travels on the tennis circuit for up to nine months a year. He's been travelling and reporting on tennis for 30 years. He covers the sport on radio and TV, as well as a number of websites, including those of Serena Williams and Andy Roddick. So Craig is on the line from Sydney. And Craig, welcome to You Cannot Be Serious. The first thing I'd like to ask you is I texted you and said we use You Cannot Be Serious from when John McEnroe was defaulted here in Melbourne. And you very kindly and subtly texted back and said, no, mate, that's not correct. He said you cannot be serious when he was defaulted out of an American tournament. When was that, Craig?
No, well, he actually used it, but you can continue with the accolades, by the way, and you've left out multimedia megastar. But as far as Johnny Mack was concerned, he actually first used that at Wimbledon when he said you cannot be serious. And he actually hates people throwing that back at him, because many people will use that line at Johnny Mack, and he'll say, can't you think of something else?
Well, he wrote a book on it.
Well, yeah, but he'll play it up for himself. But sometimes he gets fed up when people put it back at him. But it is in tennis folklore; it doesn't change. I mean, the other one was chalk was on the line. Chalk flew up, or things yep. like that. But yeah, he came up with some classics.
So I'm sorry we didn't give you didn't go on with the accolades, Craig. But I think your reputation does precede you. I've known of you for all those years, and I've got Don with me, and we have another gentleman besides here. He's called Paul. Just before we get on to the topic of the world, what I suppose tennis has never been the same since Mr. McEnroe departed, for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah,
or maybe it has.
Well, it has changed for sure, but between himself and Jimmy Connors, they really brought it up for notoriety in the 70s and 80s because of the way they carried on. And then there was also the late Vitas Gerulaitis, who could also be incredibly hot-tempered. In fact, he's the only player I know of or can remember of where the lines people actually went on strike and refused to do a match of his. And that was at Festival Hall in Melbourne, when there used to be an indoor tournament there. So, yes, there are a few players that had reputations.
And why did Vitas Gerulaitis, I remember him well, I think he succumbed to the Bolivian booger sugar, didn't he? He gave that a fearful pounding. What did he do to the lines? Did he abuse them, did he? Or they said,
we're
not getting balls for him if he continues like that.
Yeah, exactly. It had to do with the abuse and the way he treated them and things like that. So they had enough, and they targeted him and said, well, we're on strike, we're not doing it. And there was quite a bit of discussion before they came back on to agreeing to do matches of his.
Now, this is Don Scott, Craig.
Craig, you've fascinated me
initially back in the '80s, nineties, when you started doing this reporting, how hard was it to get your gig up and running?
Yeah, in those days, it was probably a bit easier. And it was so, so different. I miss those years. I genuinely do. Now it's a 24-hour cycle. You're on call 24 hours with social media and the digital systems and 24-hour news cycles and things like that. Everything can be emailed. So it's quite different and it's way more intense. In those days, you know, things would pretty much finish. There were not really the extension of night matches and things, but things would finish at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. And if you're at Roland Garros in Paris at the French Open, a couple of us would sneak onto one of the back courts on the clay and have a hit until the security people would throw us off. But we got away with a lot more, and there was a lot more free time. So, you know, you would mix with the players directly a whole lot more. It's so different now. And in my view, most of it changed with that tragic incident of Monica Seles' stabbing. That's when I think things really started to change in tennis.
The thing, there's a couple of things that came out of that, but the first I'll ask you, are you a tennis nerd, and do you sit and watch every game of tennis?
Oh, look, it is a passion of mine and always has been, but you need to have a bit of an escape as well. You know, when I'm at a tournament like the Australian Open or US Open and you've got day-night matches, it's like a full-week event. And I would average, and this is not a lie, it's the absolute truth, I would average about 3 hours sleep a night. You know, because of the late sessions and you've got to be up early to start all over again. And with New York, you're dealing with the time differences also. And it's not just Australia that I'm covering for. It's the international market, you know, with a network like Voice of America, which is, you know, has a listenership of about 170 million people. So, you know, it's not just the Australian players that you're necessarily following or the bigger names. It's across the board.
Now, the game has changed a lot of games. Mm. It has evolved. Are there things that you can put it down to that have caused the evolution of the game? For example, back in the 50s, if we go back there, they were all wooden-framed rackets, gutted. Then you change the stringing, the rackets. You can look at courts and things along that line. Are there certain things that along maybe three or four that have really influenced the change of the game? And can you compare the players of today with the players of yesteryear?
No, you can't, because it's a completely different generation, you know, and you've touched on it with the equipment and the surfaces. I mean, in those days, there were more matches and tournaments playing on the natural surfaces like grass, like clay. Well, hard courts now are the biggest thing on the tour. There's more hard court events than anything else. And that surface is so wearing on the body, on the knees, the ankles, the back. And Rafa Nadal has been through so many injuries playing on hard court and surgeries and things like that.
What a person he is.
Oh, he's a great guy. He is a fantastic guy. You know, so it is more stressful on the body now, and the equipment and the balls could be heavier or a bit lighter, and that has an impact on the arm. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that have to be considered. In my view, in the 80s, two people changed the direction on how tennis was looked at and worked on. Ivan Lendl and Martina Navratilova, because they really stressed the diet and the physical training. And then things have progressed with different levels of play, different periods and eras of players that came through after that.
Now, Craig, and I'm saying this to you and to the people listening, in case you think we're just going to get the history of tennis from you and not speak about Mr. Djokovic, nothing could be further from the truth, but we're teasing people. We're just going to ask you what we want to ask you before we get onto that. Do the Do the stars of the game, the men and women alike, are they wary of you, or do they have they embraced you? Do you ever ruffle any feathers, or have you ever been, or not? Or are you just a reporter?
I do tend to ruffle some feathers on occasions, but I'm a great admirer of what these people have achieved and what they continue to achieve. And I look at the game, and I'm not there for the social, for the gossip aspect. Yeah, you keep it in it. You hear about it, and it's in your mind and all that. But it's the game and what their personalities are like. I've gotten pretty close in friendship or association with Daniil Medvedev, the world number two. There was a couple of funny incidents which I didn't even know about till it was related to me last night. He came into a post-match media conference and didn't see me in either in the room or on the monitor. And he said, "We can't start. Craig's not here." So that's really nice. There was more of a relationship and friendship with the players from the 80s and early 90s, Stefan Edberg, Boris, Ivan, and I was very close to Lendl, Martina, Chrissy. I still exchange messages with all of them. Mats Wilander, I was speaking to him on the phone about a couple of months ago. So, but now, as I was saying, it is a little bit, there's more of a separation
between them. You didn't mention Bjorn Borg. Was that just an oversight, or was he a bit remote?
No, but I was never really that close friends with Bjorn. I had more of a relationship with Jimmy and with John, Matt. Bjorn was still a little bit before me. Jimmy and Mac played well into the 80s, whereas Bjorn retired so early. I see him once in the way, and we might exchange some niceties, but... Can you
clinically rank the best men and women that you've seen?
No.
For what you can't do that?
It's okay. Too difficult.
What about?
Hang on a minute, Don. Just yep. he might say he can't, but then he just might.
it's too difficult because of these eras. I mean, can you say Rod Laver is the same as Roger Federer, or that Pete Sampras is the same as Ken Rosewall or something like that?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I can say Rod Laver, for his, he took it to a different level. He came over the top of his backhands, and I think his record. But as you say, it's impossible, isn't it, really?
What about wasting?
Look, it's very sexy to be able to talk about the greatest players of all time and list them because of the number of events they've won. And that's also a big difference, because when somebody like Rocket and Muscles and Nuke and all those guys were playing, there weren't as many tournaments around, and then you lost it for so long with some of these guys because of they went professional when the amateur era was still going on, didn't get that opportunity to play Wimbledon for so many years, or the Australian Championships, not the Open, but the Championships, because it only went open in Australia in 1969 and on the circuit as a whole in 1968. So there, the equipment, the training, and all that sort of stuff. So that's why it's so difficult.
What about wasted talent, Craig?
Yeah.
Give me somebody or some people.
Mark Philippoussis for a bit. I mean, a lovely guy. I love Mark, but he should have done so much or achieved so much more. He achieved a lot, but should have done so much more. Tomic is a perfect example. During this Australian Open qualifying, what a mess he made of things there after saying he's changed. Not a chance. A leopard doesn't change its spots. So there are those sort of people that you would like to have seen progress further. I mean, people will say Nick Kyrgios as well. But the other side of the way I also look at it, well, it's their lives. It's what they feel they want to do and achieve, and who are we to really question that?
Now, in case we get accused of being sexist, we've spoken a lot about the men, but...
You do.
Now, in case we ignore the other half of what this game's about, The Williams duo, the Margaret Courts, the Margaret Smiths, the Martin. They are just as captivating and exciting in their own, well, not in their own right. Just they are just as captivating and exciting, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. For my money, the greatest on the women's side was Stephanie Graf. She doesn't like being called Steffi, by the way. It's Stephanie Graf. For what she achieved something that no other player has ever done, and that's win the Golden Slam, to win all four of the majors and the Olympic gold medal in a single calendar year. Andre Agassi has done it, having achieved all five. Her husband, Rafa has done it, but it's never been done all in one year. And she did it in 1988. I was at every one of those events that she achieved that status. So, but you know, Margaret Court, it really annoys me no end with the way the Americans carry on to just ignore her because they don't agree with her beliefs.
Yep.
Well, I don't agree with her beliefs, but you cannot ignore or deny what she achieved on the tennis court. Oh,
very glad you said that, because I was going to mention that. I was going to ask you what your opinion of that was, so I'm very glad that you cover that. Can I take it that you wouldn't single a man out, but you've singled Stephanie Graf out as the best woman player?
You know, on the men's side, look, as I was saying, it's tough on both sides. But I used to love watching Stephanie, and I got a kick out of Martina as well. I would probably go with Rocket and Fed on an equal basis. But remember, Rocket won his four majors, the Grand Slam, and three of them were on grass at that time.
Oh yeah, fair enough.
It's all different surfaces now. I mean, the Australian Open hard court is a different hard court to the US Open. You've still got the grass at Wimbledon and the clay at Roland Garros.
Why do countries, is it cycles, Craig, or is there a real effort by various countries? Australia, America back in the 50s, 60s, you've got the European countries really coming to the fore. America was hot there for a couple of years. At the moment, it seems to be a bit of a mixed bag.
I think there is that aspect of things going in cycles. I mean, South America was dominating for a while when Guillermo Vilas was at the top of the game. They also had José Luis Clerc, who was a right royal pain in the backside at the best of times.
Maria
Buena, who passed away last year. So they did have players in that neck of the woods, but it does go around in cycles. I mean, the Swedes absolutely dominated the game. I was sitting and chatting with Joachim Nyström a few days ago, and we were remembering back to that period when Bjorn was there, Matt, Stefan, Joachim Nyström. There was such a lineup of Swedish players. The Italians are dominating now. The Russians are dominating now. It seems like there's 50 Italians in the top 100. I mean, obviously that's an exaggeration, but the number of Russians in the top 10 alone. So it does go around in roundabouts, let's say.
One player that fascinated me, and I wondered whether he got everything out of his ability, was Henri Lacan.
Mm.
Did he get everything out? Did he have anything else to give, or was he distracted? Because I did enjoy his antics. I thought he was very funny.
Yep.
But could he have achieved more?
I think he could have probably achieved more. One of the great matches that I saw was at the French Open. Yannick Noah, who I adore, lovely guy, was playing Henri Lecomte. The crowd didn't know who to go for at Roland Garros. And it was unbelievable. It was sensational stuff. Henri was a lovely guy. He's so funny.
So that's amazing you mentioned Yannick Noah. I interviewed Yannick Noah when he was out here, and I was doing some work for the Herald Sun, or it was the Sun in those days.
Mm.
And he told me, I've got this on tape. He said he did. It made love to a ball girl in the change rooms during the tournament.
Dear.
I you maybe should not. I have that. I have him saying that on tape.
Well,
so
okay.
I thought he was a bit of a lad.
I first
probably be put in jail now.
Probably. But I first met Yannick. It was at White City in Sydney, the original home of the tournament here. And I was playing juniors. And I was reading a magazine. It was World Tennis Magazine on one of the benches outside. And he came and sat next to me. He was a junior. And on the cover of the magazine was Arthur Ashe. And he asked me if he could look at the magazine. So we started chatting. And obviously it was Arthur, the late, great Arthur Ashe, who found or discovered Yannick Noah in Cameroon on a scouting mission with clinics and things like that. And, so that was the first time. I think that would have been probably 75 or 74, yep, around then. Yeah, and then now, Yannick wins the French Open a few years later.
Now, Craig, this is the last question. This is just a bit of window dressing, but I'm interested. Mm. But before we actually ask you why we got you on the line, surely the way of the game is to dispense with lines men and lines women and just have virtual line calls done by a machine. That seems to be the fairest.
Electronic.
Electronic. It seems to be. Is that been perfected enough for that just not to only have a chair umpire and no one else?
Yeah, look, I'm not in favor of it.
Aren't
because
you?
Because you take the human element out of the whole thing.
Isn't that a good idea?
I think it becomes too clinical then. You want to see some personality on the court as well. And, there are still many tournaments that are still using lines people. I don't know if Wimbledon would ever go away from it. It may come back to the Australian Open. And so much of it also has been developed because of the present world environment effort to reduce the number of people around a tournament. The U.S. tournaments, I think, will stick with it because that's their mentality on the aspect and various things. But I would like to see humans back on the court.
Okay, Craig. Now, in relative terms, is there about to be a bigger story ever in world tennis that's about to erupt here in Melbourne in the next day or so?
It's pretty staggering. I mean, it's not just a tennis story. It's a political story. It's a world story with the entry of somebody into a country and the requirements and things like that. So I think it goes beyond being a tennis story. And it is so frustrating to having to deal with it. It has become and continues to be so muddy and murky, and I described it as on the muddy side, like the Yarra floating upside down. It is just a terrible situation that we're in at the moment.
I presume you haven't spoken to Djokovic or his team. I said I presume you haven't, but your opinion is what? What is the opinion of the players that you understand, and what do you think the ramifications of this will be for Djokovic and the game, really?
Yeah, I think the players are split on it. They're saying they feel the vaccination aspect is crucial, that he should be vaccinated, like 90 or 95% of players in the top 100. Nadal made the comment a day ago that, once the judge brought down his ruling or his decision that, we have to get on with things now, but the vaccination needs to be looked at and made a mandatory situation. It is very, very difficult. It really is difficult for everybody, and especially people who are close to in this sport, to see things go to this sort of a situation.
So Craig, I'm probably missed this in the whole gambit of what's been said. But did Djokovic provide? Did he provide a medical exemption as to why he did he provide the medical exemption as to why he didn't have to be or wasn't vaccinated? I can't quite understand. He's surely not allowed into the country. No one is allowed into the country, no matter what their opinion is, unless they get tested for COVID. You just can't come into a country. And if he can you, or did he? Surely you're tested at the gate or before you leave that you haven't got it, aren't you? Whether you've been vaccinated or not.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is the case. So he is understood, and I believe this aspect, that he is clear on COVID.
Right.
But you know, he's now negative. He apparently had it in December.
Yes.
About the middle of December. Now, what was strange on this situation, I'll give you an example of myself on this, but what's strange on this...
Have you had it?
Is that... No, I haven't. Mm-hmm. I've had three vaccines, and I'm probably going to get a fourth one in late February before I have to go back overseas. But the timeline is also confusing, because there was a deadline for any medical exemptions. He's applied apparently on that deadline, but then has tested positive after that. Now, he had COVID in June 2020, and he was shouting it from the rooftops that he had had it, when which he gained from that ill-fated exhibition tour, the Adria tour that he had put together. This time, funny how there was an extreme silence. The silence, in fact, was deafening, that he had had COVID again. Now, if COVID was to be used as one of the reasons for a medical exemption, which has been denied, it's not one of the exemption points or possibilities, you'd think that he'd want people to know that he had had it, and that was the reason he was trying to get his medical exemption. Now, on top of all that, there is a situation where he's tested positive, and the next day he's out with kids.
Yes.
No masking, no social distancing, shaking hands, handing out awards and trophies, accepting an award from L'Équipe, the French sports magazine. But so it just sort of doesn't quite add up.
No.
Now, also, he was in Spain training, and then he'd gone, flown back to between Spain and Serbia. His declaration form says that he hadn't traveled within the 14 days, which he had. So there's a lot of things that just don't seem to add up. Now, what I was just going to say to you as an example for myself, when I flew back into Sydney in December after being away for 3.5 months at tournaments, I had with me my vaccination certificate, I had a negative test, and I had prepared the passenger declaration form, which you have to do before boarding an aircraft to come into Australia. The only thing I was asked for at Madrid airport was the vaccination paper. Nothing else was looked at or asked for. So it's a bit strange.
It is very strange. Now, you will find this probably a very naive thing for someone like me to say. So what does it matter if he was tested, didn't have COVID, came into the country? If he gets it here, someone in Australia is going to give it to him, whether they've been vaccinated or not. The vaccine, they tell us, that there is no guarantee that you don't get COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Masks are useless. Self-distancing is useless. What does it matter if he was at a function after he was cleared of having COVID over and shaking hands with kids? What does all that matter? It seems to be, no one seems to have any positive input into what is going on in the world, and he is just exposing the fact that it is just a schmozzle, Craig.
it is a schmozzle and a contradiction in a lot of areas. There's absolutely, I can't disagree with that, but there are rules and regulations and guidelines that have to be followed, and those are the rules and regulations and guidelines of this country. There is the discrepancy on a couple of aspects that has raised the red flag as far as he's concerned, and has also surfaced, and that indicated that he hadn't been traveling on his passenger declaration form when he had. So that's a false. And then as far as the timeline of the information for the exemption there's question marks over there. And what I'm thinking, and this is my view, is that the federal government maybe is not convinced of the information that was originally provided to obtain the medical exemption.
Yeah, so they lied, or someone filled it in not accurately.
Yeah, and,
so
and
where does
you
that...
are responsible, irrespective of who fills it in or whatever,
yep.
You are the person whose name is yes. on that. You are the one responsible.
So, Craig, in your vast experience of this, is it got down to whether Scott Morrison decides whether he plays in the Australian Open, or if Scott Morrison says, no, mate, pack up, get on the plane, is it then go to another level? Do you think he will play in the Australian Open?
Well, let me just also say that he has been provided with a lot of advantages that normally a person would not have received in this situation. One, he 9.9 times out of 10, they would have been put on the next flight back. They allowed him to stay and follow on. Two, he was put at, granted, that awful hotel. It's not a nice place. But two, on that score, ordinarily, he would have been put into a detention center. Three, he was given his phone. They never give the individual back his phone. Four, he asked for his personal chef, which was denied, but the cook or the chef, whatever, at that hotel that he was at, was allowed to make food specifically for him. Now, I've been in 2 weeks of hotel quarantine, and let me tell you, it is an awful situation to be in. But he was given some of those privileges. Now, as far as what might happen, even if the government and Alex Hawke, the immigration minister, decides to cancel his visa a second time, the lawyers will go to the same judge, and we know it's going to be the same judge, Judge Kelly in Melbourne, who will then more than likely issue a temporary injunction. And that would allow him to continue to play the Australian Open anyway.
So you're not saying you're mystified that there's one set of rules for some people and one set for another, because that goes on. The AFL, the NRL players in their football season were played on despite COVID being in all the camps. The head of the AFL, Gil McLachlan, got a special exemption from Mr. Dutton to have an au pair girl come in and be a nanny for it. I mean, you're not surely saying that if Craig Tilley wants the best player in the world to come here, they don't bend over backwards to make a set of rules that might be different from other people, are you?
Let's just say Craig Tardy is not involved in this, because Tennis Australia can't make the rules and the regulations. It comes from the government. But yes, there is, you know, we hate, obviously we here in this country, we hate this one rule for some, another rule for others. Now, here's the example. I was in this hotel quarantine, yet actors were coming in and were able to go and isolate at a resort. Why should that be? I live on my own in a totally detached house with 2 meter high fencing all around it. And yet I was denied. And even my Nine Radio put in a request to be able to do it at home. This was in July I'm talking about, and that was denied. When I came back in December, you had to isolate for 72 hours. And then when I'm walking out of the airport, I'm told you have to isolate for 72 hours, but you need to have a test done within 24 hours. And I said, hang on a minute. How are you going to do that if you're isolating for 72 hours? Oh, no, you're allowed to do that. And yet, somebody like Rebel Wilson comes in at the same time and is allowed to wander around and go to an awards ceremony and all that at the Opera House.
So, Craig, that's exactly my point. Why is people jumping up and down saying, oh, it's one set of rules?
Because I also think Novak was making such a fuss and coming up with so much rhetoric and bravado about his stand that it attracted more attention to him.
All right. Well, now, Craig Gabriel, we very much appreciate your insight into all this. I'm not sure I could ask you 100 questions about tennis because I remember going watching Vic Satius and all those people play at Kooyong when American tennis was good, and Barry Mackay and all those people.
Yes.
You wouldn't remember those people, probably.
I do remember them. Yep.
Yeah, all those. So it's very kind of you to jump on the line and speak to us, and we will watch with interest your prognostications and deliberations about what's going on, which will be the biggest tennis story probably of the decade. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.